Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. For more than four decades, today's guest has been a social and environmental justice leader. Architect Carl C. Anthony has worked tirelessly to build bridges, literally and figuratively, between the environmental and racial justice movements. Anthony has been a prominent voice in bringing attention to some of the most pressing issues of our time. And he's written a new book. It's called The Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of Race. And in that book, he notes, and I quote, "We need a new story about race and place in the United States. This new story will not ignore the toxic waste dumps and stockpiles of hazardous materials located in our neighborhoods, but it will go beyond that to affirm the fundamental truth that all people are connected to all creation." Carl C. Anthony is an architect, regional planner, and a social justice leader, and co-founder of the Breakthrough Communities Project, and a visiting professor at UC Davis Center for Regional Change. He joins us in studio. Thank you so much for being here, Carl. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And also joining us in studio is Dr. Paloma Pavel. She is president of the Earth House Center and co-founder of the Breakthrough Communities Project. Her academic background includes graduate study at the London School of Economics and Harvard University, and she has taught many Bay Area institutions, including the California Institute for Integral Studies. She's a frequent lecturer and keynote presenter nationally and internationally, and her theory of living systems and urban sustainability are all part of the whole narrative that we're going to discuss today. So thank you so much for being here, Paloma.
Great to be here, Renee.
It's been a real treat to read your book, Carl Anthony, The Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of Race. So can you just talk about, after four decades of work in both architecture and integrating the narrative of race, why did you decide to write the book now, and what did you want to say?
Well, you know, I was a student of architecture during the 1960s, and at the same time, I was very much involved in the civil rights movement that was making front page news. And I had a very difficult time integrating those issues that were on the front pages with what I was learning about architecture and urban planning. And this dichotomy between two ways of thinking affected me very deeply, and I've struggled for the last 40 years to really put them together. And I decided, after we had completed our last project, that we really needed to complete this narrative and bring them together in a single story.
And you were raised in Philadelphia, which turned out to be a really significant reason for the trajectory that your life took, starting with how William Penn laid out the city. And so talk about how those things, how that, something as basic as having learned about that in school, kind of started you on your path.
I was in the third grade. I had a wonderful third grade teacher. And we learned about William Penn and his founding of Philadelphia, and his laying the city out with the park places in each of the four quarters of the city. And we learned that he coined this the city of brotherly love. We learned about how he met the Native Americans and how he was very conscious of the value of equality between himself and the Native people that he found here. What the narrative did not say, and I did not really find out about this until probably two decades later, was that William Penn had slaves. And this was kind of a shock to me because he was such a powerful progressive figure at that time in the 17th century. And not only did he have slaves, he found Africans living here when he arrived on the banks of the Delaware River. But possibly more important than that, his father had been an admiral in the British Navy, and he made his money on the slave trade. And what had happened was King Charles had borrowed a significant sum from William Penn Sr., and he wanted to repay King Charles wanted to repay that, and he gave him the land which became Pennsylvania. So from a childhood growing up where African Americans were completely invisible in any story of the founding of this city, to find that our own history that traced back many, many decades was actually central to the founding of Pennsylvania.
And you grew up in a fabulous, a mansion, actually, a three-story mansion in an area that had tree-lined streets, mature trees. And, I mean, who knew that African Americans could live in a community like that? But when you moved there as a child, it was actually a mixed community, and that changed. And actually, your neighborhood became what you call a ghetto. So how influential was the start out of that neighborhood for you and how it ended up in terms of your thoughts on urban planning and such?
Well, I was born in the Bottom, which was the area of Philadelphia where poor people lived. And it basically had been a swamp which developers had made possible housing for poor people. But when I was 5 years old, we moved to the new area of Philadelphia in which the white people who were there were, I wasn't aware of it when I moved there, but they were in the process of moving out. So we managed to get a house that was actually designed for the upper middle class or the middle class. And this was, from my point of view, a mansion, because when I compared it to the place where I was born, it was a really terrific place. And so, and I also went to an integrated elementary school, which in this particular case, there were 12 African Americans who were in a school that had about 300 or 400 people, students. So it was a radical change from the place that I had been born.
Interesting, though, that when you started to notice that whites were beginning to move out of this fabulous neighborhood, they were going to suburbs where their homes were actually kind of two-story, cinder block, not very impressive. But somehow in your mind, you thought those were better than the beautiful three-story mansion in which you lived. Talk about how your whole idea about race and place were impacted by those changes.
Well, you know, it was constantly facing contradictions that seemed to be very difficult to resolve. Here we were living in a place that was much, much bigger and much more generous than the place we had moved. But the white people who were living there had just moved out, and we were the first wave of African Americans that moved to this neighborhood. And as I lived there and grew up, the neighborhood began to change because there were many African Americans that had migrated to the city just at a time when the jobs and the money from that part of the city were withdrawn for the building of suburbs. And so the place eventually became a ghetto.
You know, it's interesting. I have a hunch. Your experience is very, very common. I know that was my experience. I went to an integrated elementary school. My parents were both working people. My mom was a maid. My daddy was a steel worker. I grew up in Cleveland. And so I watched the neighborhood change. And then recently, all of a sudden, this now all black neighborhood, all of those mature trees that had taken 20, 30 years to grow, they came in and chopped them down. And so, you know, it got me wondering just how much of what we see as disinvestment and white flight, how much of that is engineered and how much of it is coincidence?
I don't think any of it is coincidence. I think the main thing that I would say is that our our building traditions actually are designed primarily around one single fact, which is to maximize the profit of individual developers. So, so to that extent, the experience that we had was engineered by somebody for their own purposes, which is how they can make money at the cost of various other people and the benefits for other people. So I think it was heavily engineered, and then in between the cracks, we managed to adapt to what was available to us.
Adaptation and capitalism, those two things mm-hmm. have always seemed to go hand in hand when it came to low and moderate income communities, black and brown neighborhoods, and those changes that happen when capitalism becomes an issue. Let's invite our listeners. Carl Anthony is here. He's the author of The Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of Race, a very, very common and very associated name with the Bay Area. We're podcasting the show. And if you have questions for Carl Anthony, please give us a call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And, you know, I think that as you were growing up, the fact that your father was influential in your life was important as well. He was actually quite good with his hands. He had a workshop in the basement, and you and your brother worked there, and perhaps that kind of hands-on experience played into your
life story.
Well,
absolutely. You know, I had a wonderful childhood. And particularly after we had moved to this beautiful place. And we had a book that was called Fun for Boys. And my father bought the machines that were advertised as being for the home handyman. And so we had all these machines in the basement, and we were invited by him to make our toys.
And your childhood also included, as you kind of grew up, to being a house painter and even an architecture student. So can you talk about how working with your hands in your dad's basement translated into you becoming a student of architecture?
Well, you know, the associations, of course, are now quite rich. And as I think about our experience growing up, and I have to also credit my mother, who was a pattern maker. She was interested in making clothes, and so she would make these drawings of the patterns that got sewn together to make various outfits. So both of my parents were really oriented toward making beautiful things, and I picked that up by osmosis, I guess.
And you entered college. How did that happen?
Well, it's a long story, and it had some misadventures. I was supposed to get into the University of Pennsylvania because my father moved to this neighborhood in order that my brother and I would have an opportunity to go to the University of Pennsylvania, which was about a mile away from where we lived. But as it turned out, there was a mistake that happened in my transcript, and I did not complete my application to the University of Pennsylvania, and so I decided to go to New York. And since my grades were pretty good, I got into Columbia University, although I did have to go through the night school. And then I studied there for 4 years before I went to architecture school. And I got involved in the civil rights movement during those days.
Isn't it interesting how serendipity forms our lives' path? So your foray into the civil rights movement, certainly, I don't know anybody else who somehow dovetailed architecture and activism in the way that your life has. So how did those two things dovetail?
Well, you know, it was a kind of miraculous thing. I had been reading a wonderful book by Lewis Mumford. Some of you may remember him from earlier years. He was the nation's number one architecture critic, and he wrote a book called The City in History. And I had been actually almost hypnotized by his books. And when he finished The City in History, I wrote him a note saying, "Hey, this was really a cool idea. Let's have lunch." And the audacity of somebody writing a letter to an author who had published every issue of the New Yorker had a line item by him, and then I was shocked. Within a week, I got a letter back, and the letter said, "Dear Mr. Anthony, I really appreciated hearing your story. It reminded me of my own youth as I started at night school, and unfortunately, I'm going to be away in England. Since I have just finished a long time writing a book, but I would be willing to entertain sharing letters with you. And so I responded to him. I thought, well, gee, this guy write me a letter. I'll write him one back. And then the answer came a week later, and then I wrote, another letter, and I wrote four or five letters before he started to wear me out.
He wore you out.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Who'd have thunk it, right, that
exactly.
You could correspond with someone like this? And you were able to somehow bring together the issues of development, architecture, race, gentrification, and climate. Can you talk about that intersection?
Well, it really shouldn't be so surprising to people because we all interact with all these things. It's only because we have learned to segment the work that we do from the work that other people do that we generally think of them as being isolated. But right now, I think the biggest threat, or one of the biggest threats for humanity on the planet, is climate change. And the idea that the atmosphere is warming up, and it has enormous, enormous implications for the whole society. But one of the things that has been pointed out by the World Bank is that if we don't do something about this change in climate in the next generation, in the next decade, over 100 million people will be pushed into poverty from extreme weather events. And we've seen so many of them happen just recently, and we can expect a lot more.
Let's go to our first caller. Bob in Oakland wants to ask about race and climate. Hi, Bob. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Hey, Carl. It's Bob Allen. How are you?
Hey, man. How you doing?
I'm good. I just want to thank you again for the book and just for all your contributions for all the work you've done in the field. And just one thing I wanted to ask you was, could you talk a little bit about the intersections between what's happening with regional planning, climate change, where we're seen as a leader here in the Bay Area and California, and how that may be unintentionally or intentionally exacerbating the problem of racialized displacement of black communities out to the suburbs? I know it's been something you've been a leading thinker on, and just if you could talk to folks about that, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts about where we are in terms of how we address climate change without reversing the patterns of post-World War II kind of suburban-urban relations.
Well, thanks a lot. Of course, you've been on the front lines of this for the last decade or two. I was very concerned about the potential coming wave of issues that communities of color would face. As it turned out, the black people had migrated to the inner cities during the Second World War, or just before the Second World War, up until the end of the 60s. And they bought houses. I can't really believe, as I think back, of what the prices were like then. But so we had gotten used to the idea that the black people and the poor people would live in the inner city, and then the cities would grow by suburban development, and the white people would move out to the cities. And the main thing is that they took their money and took the resources and their educational opportunities with them. And so as the inner cities dried up, the African Americans and others were concentrated in these cities, and the white people moved out to the suburbs. And for a number of years, this was this great dichotomy between the whites living in the suburbs and the blacks living in the inner city. And then the state of California, which is a leader globally with climate change, passed legislation that required the state to figure out how to reduce the CO2 emissions, because the CO2 emissions were the major cause of climate change. It turned out that 40% of the CO2 emissions came from people riding back and forth in automobiles.
Mm.
And this is a phenomenon that actually was one generation, a little bit more than one generation old, because before that, there used to be trolley cars and whatnot that connected to people. So the legislation called SB 375 was passed, and what it ordered all of the transportation agencies in the state, which were there are 18 of them, each in the metropolitan area, to look at the transportation and find ways of reducing the CO2 emissions. And they, lo and behold, they looked at this pattern of people riding around in automobiles and said that we've got to do something to reduce this or eliminate this. So many of the communities, particularly the communities of color, were had mixed feelings about this new legislation, and they made a decision to support the legislation, but they were alarmed because they thought it might lead to displacement. And lo and behold, it did lead to displacement, and the communities that lived close to the transportation infrastructure were, you know, originally in a position to actually gain from this new legislation. But the fear was that as the white people decided to move back to the cities, the people of color would be displaced out to the suburban areas. And lo and behold, that's what happened. And so we had the destruction of the inner city neighborhoods where the poor people were located very close to the transportation infrastructure. Now we're forced out and we're moved to the suburbs, the most extreme places out in the suburbs, while the rich white people return to the city.
And so, why do I think that this doesn't take you by surprise, that you saw this coming?
I saw it coming. You know, I guess the first that I thought about it was when we were founded, the Urban Habitat Program. This was an awareness. We were aware of this, and that was in 1989. So it's taken us, you know, 25 years to actually bring this to public consciousness. But right now it's really having a devastating effect on our communities. There are some benefits, however, that also have come with this change, because as the people move out to the other to the suburbs, now the African Americans move out to, and especially to the poor suburbs, they have a little bit more potential for having some regional power. But the basic fact is that to lose your own home is a devastating act.
Can't wait to hear your thoughts on what the next 30-year cycle is. You're probably going to sound like a real fortune teller, because I have a hunch you know what's going to happen in terms of housing, architecture, and race 30 years hence. And I can't wait to hear your thoughts on that. And we hope that folks will join us. 866-798-8255 is the number. And architect and activist Carl Anthony is our guest. And we're also joined in studio by Dr. Paloma Pavel. She's the president of Earth House Center and co-founder of the Breakthrough Communities Project, and started the Urban Habitat Program back in 1989. Can't wait to hear her perspective on what we can expect in the next 30 years. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. And for those of you just joining us now, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org, and you can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, we love that. Drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'd love to have you join us today. The phone number is 866-798-8255, or you can leave us a comment on the website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, legalized pot. Ready or not, it's coming starting January 1st. Is your city ready? So that's on the next Your Call tomorrow. Today, we're talking to Carl Anthony, and we're talking about his new book, The Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of Race. Suddenly, I feel like it's not so hidden anymore. It's been an interesting half hour so far, and we hope you'll join us. What questions do you have for our guest? And how do you think racial and economic demarcations are actually clearly reflected in our urban landscape? And is it even possible to create economically and racially viable, clean, inclusive cities. Is it possible? We'd love to hear from you. Also like to bring it at this point, Dr. Paloma Pavel. She's the president of the Earth House Center, and she's the co-founder of the Breakthrough Communities Project. Thanks for your patience, Dr. Pavel. It's great to have you here. And the two of you, you and Carl Anthony, have worked hand in glove, hand in hand, side by side, in parallel for years now, for decades. So just bring us up to speed on, give us the arc of the architecture and activism movement.
Thank you, Renee. What we're seeing today is something that we call spatial apartheid. Mm-hmm. And when we look at how our cities are designed, with the built environment actually reflecting some of our own history of separation, of segregation, fragmentation, and also our fear among one another, and the prejudice and violation that racism has been since the founding of this country.
Is there an area in the Bay Area that you could point to that specifically is this apartheid that you're talking about, this built-in architectural, if you will, apartheid? That's for you or Carl.
Well, I think that the process of producing this is apartheid has been so natural, so to speak, with quotation marks, that people have not even noticed it. But when I first moved to the Bay Area and I was on the faculty at UC Berkeley in the Department of Architecture, I noticed that there was a very strange pattern that most of the professors in my department lived in the suburbs. And then I began to hear, you know, facts about the evolution of the suburban movement, and I found that when the first laws were passed for integrated schools, many of the population of Berkeley, which had been white and also controlled by Republicans, moved out to the suburbs. And the black people moved into the city, and the white people moved out to the suburbs because they didn't want to have their children associated with the integrated schools that were supposed to be created in the inner city. So we started with the idea of integrating the city. The black people moved here after the Second World War. And until the 1970s, we had an overwhelmingly large African-American population. Today, the population in the inner city is reduced. In Berkeley, for example, it was 25% in the 70s when I first arrived. Now it's only 4%.
And not by accident.
Not by accident.
Paloma?
Thank you. I think another phenomenon we can look at is in Oakland what we call the hills and the flatlands, where the life expectancy, which has been well documented by Dr. Tony Eitan and others, of life expectancy in the hills is 10 years longer than someone born in the flatlands. And there we've also been able to track how your life expectancy and quality of life can be determined by the zip code that you live in. So this points to the aspect of not only race and class segregation, but also quality of life and health impacts of living in certain regions. I think also we can think about something like Richmond and Marin, where we intentionally for years had no public transit at all between these two places living right next to one another, one of them having one of the highest incomes in the United States, the other one having at points 30 and upwards unemployment rates. And here are businesses closing down in Marin due to lack of workers, and the solution is right in our midst here in the Bay Area. So as we start thinking like a region and learning to think more as a whole system, as an entire, that the benefits need to be shared and the burdens need to not be placed on specific communities like Bayview Hunters Point, which has one of the largest concentrations of Superfund sites in the United States.
And yet, it's in the process of being transformed into and being gentrified into a very desirable area. How do you account for, either you or Carl, the fact that suddenly somebody realized, wait a minute, we've got 360-degree views. This is a prime spot. We just have to clean it up now that the black folks are moving out. I mean, how do you account for that epiphany on someone's part? Carl?
Well, I think the developers are aware of these trends, and they were aware of the fact that the people in Silicon Valley were about creating a new way of thinking about our information needs and restructuring the global economy. And in the process of doing that, along with their counterparts in other developed countries, their incomes started to skyrocket. But they found out that people did not want to live in Silicon Valley, especially the young people who were actually involved in creating this movement toward the information age. So they wanted to live in, and the developers predicted this. So the first pioneers who were to move into these neighborhoods, so-called ghetto neighborhoods, mm-hmm. were artists, right? The artists got the lofts and things like that and moved into the neighborhood, and everybody said, well, these are brave pioneers. And then when the artists moved in and sort of took over some of the spaces that were not really desirable for anybody else, then the developers looked at this and said, you know, we could make some money off of this. So then they didn't rename it as they did in other cities across the country. They didn't really rename Bayview Hunters Point, although I wouldn't be surprised if that comes along later. But they began to plan on how we can clean it up and then move the poor people out and make money off of it.
I know that I've been watching over the years, been in the Bay Area long enough, that I've covered stories in the Bayview, and people talked about how denuded it was. There was no grass, there were no shrubs, there were no trees, there was always the threat of violence and gunfire, and yet even in the midst of all of that, I started to see a gentrification process where people didn't mind opening a little coffee shop right in the midst of all the gunfire. People with money and means started walking their baby carriages down some of those very streets. And I guess, what was the harbinger? If there was a way to predict that that was going to happen so that we'll know it the next time that we see it, what was the harbinger? How did we know this is about to be transformed?
Well, you know, the thing is there were many trends that were happening at the same time. One was the civil rights legislation that was passed in the 1960s was quickly followed by the immigration laws. And what the immigration laws did was they opened up immigration to the whole world. So that no longer did they have the leaders of the country, no longer did they create a kind of a monopoly that you had to be from the northern part of Europe in order to be able to move to the United States. The new trend then started making this space available for people all over the world. So the dynamics started to change. And then I would say the main thing that began to take place is that we saw that in this change, in this transformation, the decline of the popularity of the suburbs. It used to be, well, if you want to get rich, move to the suburbs. Now we're finding out that it really costs more, especially in terms of transportation and so forth, to live in the suburbs. So I would say the harbinger, everything changes. And so you just have to look for the new changes and then ask the question, is this a change for the better or a change for the worse?
I imagine $4 a gallon gas will be something of a harbinger.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because suddenly urban living is just all the rage. And I suspect we could have seen that coming. Can we go back just a little bit and talk about, because you write extensively in your book, The Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of a Race, about your time in Africa and how influential that was for you. Can you just talk a bit about that and how that impacted your life as an architect and an activist?
Well, I had gone to Columbia University School of Architecture, and I had spent all of that time. In fact, even before I got into the School of Architecture, there was a wonderful exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art that was called Architecture Without Architects. And I was really fascinated by this because I was looking for examples of people of color making buildings, and I couldn't find any in any of the books that we were reading. And suddenly there was this exhibition of these people who had not been part of this so-called mainstream in Europe, who were making beautiful buildings, and they didn't have any architects. And then I found another book called Lost Cities of Africa, and that book was published in 1968 or something like that, or might have been earlier. And so my whole career, as I was getting my degree in architecture, I was confronted with the fact that the people that I was mostly concerned with were not anywhere in the books, including the 500,000 people, African people who lived in Harlem and East Harlem, and Puerto Rican people who lived in East Harlem. So, you know, the thing gradually awakened on me, and I don't know if it came as a sudden shock or whether it gradually sunk in, but that there was a dichotomy between the expectations for living as an African American and the way the whole culture worked. In fact, we were kind of the counterpoint of a culture where whenever things went up for other populations, they would go down for us.
And you found, too, that your fellow students, when they had the opportunity to travel abroad, all were flocking to Greece, and nobody seemed to be interested in going to Africa. And yet, when you got there, you realized that some of the very foundations of Greek architecture and world architecture started on the continent.
Well, you know, I think the thing that we don't quite realize in a popular sense is that hominids are a branch of the Homo species that is about 10 million years old, 6 or 7 million years old. And Homo sapiens have been around mostly in Africa for 200,000 years. And it wasn't until 90 or 100 years after they began to emerge that the people began to migrate to other continents. So even though we have this mythology about the Greek origin of everything, the truth of the matter is that there were many examples of places that were built by Africans and related people who were African or, let's say, dark-skinned people, including famous cases of Egypt that represented a different tradition.
Well, you know, I have a hunch when you came back with that approach and that position that you were considered something of a fly in the ointment, a burr under the saddle. I mean, there's lots of...
still working in that title.
How were you received when you thought it was important to incorporate that aesthetic?
Well, you know, the truth of the matter is I've always been kind of a little bit ambivalent. People would say, well, yeah, you really, that's true. What you say is true, but it's so different than what we're used to thinking about. So the first wake-up call that I had was in my trip, you know, to Africa. I kept trying to find these indigenous examples, which were everywhere in the continent. But the problem was, so was the modern world evident in much of the African places that I had visited. So I would be, like, screening out places where there were examples of plastic buckets and other minutiae that was part of the modern world so that I could get pictures of what was really indigenous. And I was, to a certain extent, successful. But the shock came to me is when I got down to the coast, there was another tradition that was starting to emerge around the 1500s, which were the slave castles that existed all along the coast.
In Senegal and Ghana and so forth.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I struggled with this, and I was planning to write a book about the traditional settlements in Africa, which were based on totally different principles than the ones that we acknowledge in the West. And then I really realized that I couldn't write a book about Africa if I didn't know who I was. And the story of who I was is really comes out of those slave castles. So instead of writing about Africa, I started to write about the plantations. And I wrote a couple of essays called The Big House and the Slave Quarter. And they were quite successful. And it took me a long time to write those, because evidence had to be gotten from some place that was not really normally normal sources.
Well, for those who haven't had an opportunity to see actual villages, it was really extraordinary. I visited, Senegal and Ghana, and saw the slave castles, and buried my hair in a village there. Got a chance to actually see village life up close, and noticed that the way huts were built was not, it was by design. They make bricks. I got to make bricks, and how important the layout was. You even talk in your book about one community, a Dogon village, I think, that had an anthropomorphic layout where the village was literally laid out like a person.
Exactly. There were parts of the village that were for each of the parts of the human anatomy. It was an androgynous figure that had symbols that were related to the head and to the breasts and the hands and the genitals and various other parts. And I said, look, this is really different. I mean, you went in, the entrance, was at the places where there were genitals. And I said, oh, my God, what kind of system is this? You know, and I'd gone to school in New York, and, you know, it was First Avenue, Second Avenue, Third Avenue, Fourth Avenue, First Floor, Second Floor. It was all based on the Cartesian grid. And the reason it was based on the Cartesian grid was because it would make it possible to sell property in Manhattan. So that's the way it got laid out. And it got laid out, early in the 1800s to do that. And the African tradition, which I think in many ways was very similar to the majority of the world's population before the period of slavery, it was based on a different principle.
Well, in many ways, you had to be a gadfly when you saw those things and brought that kind of thinking back. And fortunately, you had in Dr. Paloma Pavel, a fellow gadfly, and in 1989, the Urban Habitat Program was born. Can you talk about that a bit, Dr. Pavel, and how Urban Habitat was born?
Well, Carl, as founder of Urban Habitat, really initiated so many innovations through that. And one of the things that Carl's been talking about today is about the importance of a regional perspective. And so the Urban Habitat Program was really quite remarkable. And we started Earth House in the same year. And what we looked to in Urban Habitat was the sense of multiracial leadership and training for multiracial leadership, how at that time the environmental movement had been predominantly defined by white and mostly male environmental issues. And so to really create a whole generation of multiracial leaders who brought in perspectives of people of color and of low-income communities was a genius of Carl's work. Also, the Social Equity Caucus. He also had a remarkable way of bringing in whatever issues we were breaking into, whether it was transportation equity issues or toxics, and starting the Race, Poverty, and the Environment Journal, one of the longest-running and first environmental justice journals in the United States. Urban Habitat was a national leader in really making that information available, but also creating a very decentralized and democratic process for editing each one of those journals so that many new voices, many new perspectives were being proliferated and made visible. So the hidden narrative of race, at that time, was partly the racial knowledge and brilliance and leadership of communities of color who've been on the front lines and discovering that often the communities who are not at the table or on the menu.
So I just wanted to make a clarification, because sometimes people do get confused. I was president of Earth Island Institute, which was a global environmental organization, and you started Earth House
right
at the same time. So the story is that I started the Urban Habitat Program as part of Earth Island's program, leadership program, to really engage communities of color. And you had just come back from Maine, where you were a wilderness advocate, and you set up Earth House, which was located in Oakland. So I just want to make that point clear, because it is a little bit confusing, because people don't really know the history of these things to get it spelled out.
And are those things working in tandem?
Absolutely.
How so?
Well, you know, what we tried to do with the Urban Habitat Program was to build this multiracial leadership within the San Francisco Bay Area. And basically what had happened was the environmental justice movement was just taking off, and there was really a sense among many people that the anti-toxics agenda was largely a rural phenomenon, and it wasn't really that much related to the cities. And so, but we started the Urban Habitat Program and began to realize that not only the toxic issue, but every dimension of the environment in the city also had a racial agenda. So we tried to build on that and bring along a lot of people. And as people became successful in working, and I have to say the Urban Habitat Program, along with many of its allies working partnerships and public advocates and so forth, organizations that have been well established in the Bay Area joined forces. We set out to really address new challenges. So we were looking at the Bay Area when we started, then we moved to a concern about California, and now we're really looking at breakthrough communities as a national agenda that reinforces what we started at Urban Habitat.
And speaking of new challenges, there are two things that are pretty obvious nowadays. Those McMansions that we used to see, now it's all about a small footprint, and LTHs, little tiny houses, people living within 600 square feet. And that, it seems to me, to be just a huge shift in thinking, if nothing else. And the other issue is homelessness. There was a story over the weekend that the city of Oakland has now purchased tough sheds and taking people out of tents, but putting them in pretty much garden sheds, and that's considered a step up. So surely the two of you have thought about these two issues, and I'll start with you, Dr. Pavel, if you would. What are some of the solutions that maybe history has taught us about what to do about shrinking space availability and homelessness as an issue?
Well, thank you, Renee. So I guess we can first see that the world's populations are becoming urban. So at the turn of the century, we had 7% of the world living in cities, and the rest was rural and agrarian. And now we're moving towards 70% of the world living in cities. So this is an Oakland phenomena, it's a Bay Area phenomena, but it's also a world phenomena. And we're seeing megacities and the densification of our cosmopolitan regions around the world. And I think what it does is it really shows us that as we create solutions going forward, we're looking at housing solutions, but we need to see those as linked to transportation, so that we're building transit. We need to get, you know, out of our cars and create a world-class transit system for the Bay Area. But in all of our regions, we know that fossil fuels and the post-fossil fuel age is upon us now. and renewable energy, so that our solutions for what we call the three E's, environment, equity, and economy, are interlinked.
I'd like to reinforce that point, because as we think in silos, we create new problems at the same time that we're trying to generate new solutions. So as we think of, we're trying to say that you have to think about social and racial justice at the same time that you're thinking about the climate change. Because if we think of them as silos, we then produce new problems. We come up with solutions that really work very well for the wealthy people with climate change, but then it creates more problems for the people who are poor with climate change. So we have to think about them together, and this is what that World Report from the World Bank has said, that as we think about globally, we think about poverty. They're now recommending that we think about climate change at the same time. And this is also true in the San Francisco Bay Area, as it is in California and the nation. We have to think about social justice as at the same time that we're thinking about climate change.
And of all the people to get to talk to about those things and how they all work together, author and activist Carl Anthony, author of The Earth, The City, and The Hidden Narrative of Race. It has been such a pleasure to have you here and to talk with you. Thank you so much for being here. And Dr. Paloma Pavel, president of Earth House Center, co-founder of the Breakthrough Communities Project. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you for our callers. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's your call.